Welcome to Podcast This Escape, the podcast where we talk about the escape room that we escaped from in the previous episode of this podcast. Marcus, thank you for running that room. It was great fun.
Thank you guys for going through it. It was a lot of fun to see your guys' process.
Yeah, that was great. You were definitely a lot more on fire for solving the puzzles than I was.
Some good puzzles.
I feel like all I had was I spotted secret insults faster than you did. I don't know how
you
to interpret that.
Yeah, no,
you called that
well.
Right away.
It was great. Well, that's one of Danny's favorite types of puzzles, I think. You've written a lot of those, like read them out aloud and they turn into something else.
Yes, I absolutely do.
So, they're fun to come up with. I kind of enjoy. I also enjoyed double checking to make sure that the Australian accent versus my American accent wouldn't screw anything up.
That is always the interesting part, isn't it?
Yeah, there anywhere that could have been an issue? I just scroll through and I look for the letter R.
We do have locker and loser, but I figured that you would pronounce her the same way you would pronounce the end of the word locker.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
The real risk is the AO merges, but that didn't happen. That wasn't a problem here.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if you caught, but when I spoke for your character, I tried to say hello a little bit less I would say it.
I did notice a funny hello.
Yeah.
And it was bad. It was pretty bad. Can I give you a clean hello to put in because
no,
it feels insulting?
No.
Quiet for 1 second. Hello? There you go.
Great.
Fresh take. Go ahead.
No, just try one, but you have to try one in every accent that you know, and we'll pick the best one. So what change did you try? Were you consciously making with that? Because it's one of those things that you try to do accents. Some people are very technical about it and know what letters they're trying to affect and which ones they're not.
When I said hello?
Yeah, what were you trying to do?
I said hello.
Oh, I see. Yeah, trying to do the weird A thing and where some people hear an R at the end. It's curious.
Yeah,
the thing is, like most accents, I'm exaggerating something that is a much, much more subtle. So
there's also a thing, there's this is like a thing on the internet at the moment for Australian accents to talk about the R's at the end of oh no, having an R at the end.
R&R.
And it's one of these things where apparently this is becoming more of a thing, but I think we're a bit too old for it to really be a thing. So I hear
that said, when you said it then, it didn't sound that ridiculous,
no,
Marcus.
But I don't really, so we don't really say it, but if you hear it, it's like, okay, I get it. But it's just, it feels like it's a slightly younger generational thing.
Who knows? It could also be extremely regional.
Could be. We don't have much.
Thank you for joining this dialect, this escape, where we tear apart different
my favorite thing.
Differences.
I love talking about voices and accents. It's great.
It is true. There's a lot of our Discord chats. On the Consume This Media Discord, there's a lot of discussion of accents.
I still had a recent one from Solve This Murder where I typed up my notes for Hairdresser Homicide and that had the character Marley. M-A-R-L-E-Y.
Yes. Oh, yeah, where everyone thought we were saying
Molly. I love
Molly.
That.
That
really caught us off guard.
This character Molly, where did Molly come from? Oh, Molly.
Yeah.
It's not quite Molly either.
It's just because we would say Molly, and then for Americans, you wouldn't say the, you would say an R that we're not saying, so you think, okay, there's no R in it. And then an O and an A is the same vowel in America when it's an open R. An O is an open R sound. And so it's okay, Molly. That's Molly. And it's there's a different vowel here.
It's just very funny that even when you're hearing someone talk in the Australian accents, it doesn't translate.
Yeah,
it's still the American pronunciation is what came through, apparently.
It was very odd.
I once heard someone say the way to say good day, mate, in a stereotypical Australian accent is to say good I-E-Y-E, might, M-I-T-E, good I might. And that's close enough.
But I
don't know about that.
It's funny because you get these things with Australian accents that
rise up light. That one,
yeah,
for razor blade.
Yeah, these odd, but you end up with these accents. So it's I don't know who speaks like that, but I get why you think it's an Australian accent
for sure.
Because
it's
a Crocodile
really
Dundee
hear,
accent,
right? It's really fun to hear people do a really, really strong American accent, but not Southern or Californian or New York and. Basically, it just means that it's really nasally and they say hard R's and it kind of sounds like this.
Mm. Yeah. How all Americans sound.
Exactly. You sounded no different to me.
Yeah, it is very funny.
All right, onto the room.
Onto the room.
What were you happiest with, Billy? What were you? Did you feel most proud of?
I really like. Well, proud. I don't know, right? Because like, there was nothing that made me be like, "Ha ha! I've done a really good job on a really hard puzzle." But I will say, I really liked the way they all fit together. I loved finding the colors in the panels. I thought that was really, really smart.
Yeah, that was nice.
Breaking up the words. Because you think, why are these words broken up? And if we'd seen it first, it would have been really this like this mystery of like, why were those words broken in such a weird way? And then when you find the chords...
It could have been knowing that we were going to rearrange them and find bits and pieces, but we wouldn't have been able to put them together for colors. Yeah,
coming in knowing it and then being like, green, wait a minute, look at that.
Again, I did not immediately go to that.
You went for greed.
Whoops. I was just looking for words.
Greed, sloth, you know, and
that is one of those things that was kind of a casualty of... non-linearity. I feel like there are certain puzzles that are more satisfying when you find something before you know what it's for.
Yes.
Like if you guys would have found that panel, then it'd be like, you'd be like, okay, we need to like yell or something when we get in the control room. And then I think it might have been more satisfying when you see it in a new light, but you knew why you were going to the panels.
So we'd already seen the connection. That. But it's still a very cool puzzle. The slider one is a lovely puzzle, setting all the different faders to the different levels.
Absolutely.
It's sort of a classic logic puzzle kind of idea, and it worked out really well. It was nice, and it was a good like amount of puzzle for an audio escape room, where if we were doing a puzzle game and sitting in, like, you'd make it harder, or you'd add like a second set. But for this medium, it was like the exact right level of, haha, we've done it, we've solved it, we can move on.
I learned things from it as well.
Yeah, you learned. Yeah, you learned things. It's great.
So this the ideation of this room did come from the job I've most recently worked is as an audio engineer, specifically voiceover, mostly doing like international dubbing of English films or commercials. So work with a lot of international talents and things. So a lot of these puzzles came from what would you see for sure in a voiceover studio, and how can you puzzleify it? So, like, I knew that there needed to be something with faders.
Nice.
So, that was there. There needed to be something with a patch bay, because that's one of the tactile things you'll find in the studio.
Lovely.
There needed to be something that works with a microphone, and ideally something that could be heard, and thus bop it. Because I wanted something where sound effects equated to physical actions, and bop it was the
bop
best
it
I could
is a classic. Everybody loves a bop it.
And yet, haven't seen that many boppets in escape rooms.
No.
Just hasn't come up that often. Have seen, like, some things. I want to say that Mission Escape in The Sacrifice, where there are deliberate actions you have to take to respond to sound effects, is probably the closest you get to it.
But it's a really nice...
That was good. I appreciate the fact that you have said that, the way of coming up with what needed to be in the room first and then puzzlifying them.
Yeah.
That's always what I like.
It's a good way because it means that there's nothing in this space where we think, why the hell is that there? Like, what's going on? Mm-hmm. That's kind of obvious, and that's kind of like, it makes it feel like a real space. So it's a nice way of designing.
I think that that's the advantage of having a theme early on in escape rooms is because once you have the set dressing, that helps you come up with puzzles that you might not have thought of otherwise. You know, like I actually am also I'm pretty proud of the sound paneling one. And I don't think I would have like come up with that unless I was working with these specific things. I need something that can connect wires in a spatial grid. And I have these sound panels. So like different ideas come from what you have to work with in the room that feels on theme.
It's definitely a thing that like when people talk about like creativity and all of that sort of stuff, like the idea that restriction can breed creativity is a very helpful one, right? When you limit yourself down, you can then do something creative with those things. Whereas when it is just, then put a puzzle in here. Like, what do you mean? Put a like, I could do anything, and then you end up doing nothing because it's harder to make it make sense. And you don't know when you have something restrictive to start with. You end up with really cool ideas.
Absolutely. And your personal experience with all the audio engineering stuff led to this room. What about your personal experience with bullying?
Yeah.
No, I...
Something you want to get off your chest? Any apologies you want to make?
Or any deep trauma that we should explore very publicly?
No, no, I don't think so. I have explored trauma in Aurelius Whitlock's murder museum. I won't say which one or where it is, but definitely happened.
Killed a hamster.
For this, though,
it's the robots.
One thing that is, I think, the hardest thing about escape rooms for me is the suspension of disbelief about why is it escape room in the first place. And I just thought it'd be a fun twist to just say, okay, well, it's because you deserve it that you're locked in here. So that's kind of where that started. And then I came up with the like blackmail, like you have to say things into a mic that you don't realize what you're saying until you say it. So
That is an interesting thing. Like in a horror movie, when someone is attacked, scared, killed off, or whatever, it does branch in two directions. Perfectly innocent, wrong place, wrong time, or you are a sinning teenager and you have some fatal flaw that has driven you into this situation. Escape rooms don't explore that avenue very often.
True.
Like sometimes you're a criminal who is actively making a criminal decision there, but it is rarely a case of being punished for being a bad person.
True.
Well, I will say this. It's because it isn't fun to feel like you're a bad person. Like, I know you guys could handle it because you guys, like, again, the aforementioned exhibit you guys were on my show, you were kind of just like throwing around your weight, kind of being mean to a couple of characters. So I thought you would enjoy kind of the joke of this all. But there was one project I worked on, which was like this audio tour that like you're led to different places on the college campus. And I designed it so it's like someone who's blackmailing you is telling you like what to do. Like, all right, now you're going to drop off the drugs right there or something like that.
Yeah.
But like, it was for like a class project or something. And people were like, I don't like that this person is mean to me. Like, this isn't fun.
It's an interesting balance.
I think there's also a thing, like people talk about a lot with escape rooms of seeing how much your players will engage with like having a character or being a person in that scene, and that you want them to, but often people are just like, no, I don't, like, I'm not comfortable doing that. Like, I'm not, you know, if you're like, you're this, they'll be like, oh no, not, I'm John and I'm a guy. Like,
yeah,
you know? And so when you then flip things around to be like, the reveal is that the character that you are in the space of this escape room is a bad person, it's like, to expect them to engage with that or to even acknowledge, like, what do you mean? I'm John. I'm a guy. Like, what are you talking about?
Right.
I suppose that's why you don't see it very often, because you need specific situations like this, right, where you know the audience of this escape room and you know the kind of context of it, and you know that it's someone who's going to engage and be interested in the fact that they are that person.
Oh, sure. Trying to deal with random member of public X. Like, that's always going to be riskier in terms of anything like that. That being said, we have done things, we haven't done many things with live actors, but in terms of their characters say things that make you feel bad or make you feel stupid, that still happens.
That still happens.
That's not uncommon. You will get ridiculed. Right. You will get stressed out by them. But feeling like you deserve it in some way, you did something wrong, is an interesting one. That being said, we have also done at least one escape room where it turned out that one of your party was, twist reveal, the criminal, the murderer, or whatever.
Classic.
So to an extent it can happen, and I reckon if you build it the right way, you can totally make that a thing.
I think it's fun. It's nice to know you did it. Like, I'm glad we didn't delete our recording before we left. I'm glad that we left him with the blackmail evidence, because he deserves it. Good on him.
Whatever helps him move on.
Yeah, apparently he needed that. I do like the idea of, in the future, combining more role play with puzzle. And I guess that's kind of what I've been exploring on our own podcast. But I've had this long idea that I don't know if I'll ever be able to have the resources or time to do it. But I really like the idea of like an escape room where you come and it's actually a heist. It's like a museum and it just seems like a regular museum, but you sign up to rob the museum and you like come in character and you have to like, you know, be a thief. I feel like it'd be really fun to add more role play into it.
Weirdly, a friend of ours who also wrote a guest room set in an audio recording studio, has done that, I believe. Has done an event.
Oh my
gosh. Like a heist of a museum where you go as players, and it's like an immersive theater style thing where you are like doing the heist. I never got to do it.
Are you saying that I'm not original?
Apparently you're the same guy, so that's fun.
No, I didn't know you had already done a voiceover.
We did
escape
a podcast
room.
Recording studio.
Oh, sure.
But so that's Jim Fishwick, and he did an event or was part of an event that was like that. It was like you had to like learn where the guards were going and pull off a hide, like, and it was a large audience based sort of thing.
Mm.
I don't remember the deal. Yeah. I remember people loved it, and I never got to.
We didn't end up doing it.
But it looked very interesting.
Well, maybe I need to reach out
and steal it.
Just say I'm jealous, I guess. I don't know what else I would do.
No, Jim loves a good international collaboration. You can work with something there.
But yeah, I have one question about this room that I found interesting, that it felt in this one almost a bit lucky that it didn't break.
Ooh.
And I want to talk about it because we went to the couch in the room. And we specifically like searched the couch and like dug in through the cushions to look for a thing, found an object that led us down a whole puzzle path where the solution was you should keep searching the couch, right? Look underneath the couch.
Mm-hmm.
There's a fair chance, given that we were already searching the couch, that we would have said, oh, can we like search the cushion of the couch and like look underneath? Can we get under the couch and have a dig? What did you have a plan in place for if someone just says, I want to look under the couch before they've done the puzzle?
I might have said you feel under the couch and don't feel anything and say that the cable was taped to the bottom of it.
Yeah,
but
that's fair.
Also, if you were getting in the weeds enough, I think I would just let you skip a puzzle and feel good about yourselves.
Absolutely not.
I'd feel terrible
that's
out about
of the
myself.
Question. I was wondering, like, my immediate thought was, oh no, it's the couch. It doesn't have like empty space on the bottom. We've got to full on lift the couch to get that.
True.
So something like that.
Yeah.
So yeah, there are definitely ways to quick think. But yeah, I would never want to skip a puzzle.
No. I suppose also, like, again, right, because you have the capacity for it to be whatever you want, right? These rooms are not set in any particular way. You could very easily be like, it is under the couch. Unless they search under the couch, in which case, on the fly, I'll say, look somewhere, like, you know,
just
look
anywhere we haven't looked
on
yet.
On the ceiling, right? Anywhere you haven't looked, I'll just say, look there, and that's where it is. Like,
yep. Flexibility.
You know, you can change it in the moment if you have to, which is also, you know, which is part of the joy of this medium, that things are always however you describe them, right? There's nothing, you don't get anything locked in as long as you have time to make it.
You don't want too much improv because then things can break easily, but having a little bit of quantum placing is okay.
Give yourself a bit of capacity to be like, well, it's this way.
Yeah, well done on doing the on-air to get the computer password so quickly.
That was another,
really good.
Because I really like that as a puzzle. But it is interesting that probably if we were brute forcing it, the next thing we would have done is like, okay, we've done
not that one. Getting the computer password from it.
Oh, that one. Going noticing
like,
that.
Yes, that was very good. That first one was very good note taking on your behalf.
Yeah, I really
significantly
like that
better than mine.
Did it all happen? Were you all worried about it just being something that would be? Because I think it was a really good system, but probably quite brute forceable because there's not too many combinations of three.
Absolutely.
Things.
That was a case of, because it's an audio escape room, I only wanted it to be so complex.
Mm.
So early on, I designed a puzzle that was too difficult for me to solve. Like
I have been there.
I love it.
I had multiple switches. I was like, this one is O and I, and this one is this and this. And I was like, all right, how can I use these six switches to get on air? And I don't know if it was impossible or I just was not very good at it, but I had to drastically simplify it.
And the worst part is when someone else is doing it and they say, okay, so I flick buttons 1, 2, and 4 and then not the other three, and then you have to keep track of what's on and what's off. And when I did something not at all the same but faintly similar, that part was a nightmare and I broke a little bit.
Yeah. I would say
I actually did have it written down, every combination.
That's
just so
clever.
Like when you said, all right, we did this and this, I just have it written down so I didn't have to re-logic
it's
it.
A lot, though.
We got into a habit with these of because we had to solve a lot of these types of puzzles when we were streaming us playing through every single Nancy Drew game.
Mm.
And Nancy Drew loves what we've dubbed an associated activation puzzle, right?
Yes.
There's multiple things that can activate something and you see how they affect each other, right? So, you know, these are multiple switches that are affecting the same sign.
And writing them down in exactly the way that you did.
Like this, but the trick, the, best method the, that we the came biggest up with. Trick, so if this was more complex, rather than writing it like this, what I would have done, and this is for anyone who wants to get better at solving these at home, is I would have numerically written them all down, right? Like under, like put on air, and you're like, okay, so this switch goes like plus one, plus one, plus one, plus one. This one does plus one, and then plus one, plus, right? And then you'd be like, how can I add these together in a way that all of the numbers are even, because, or like, or odd, right? Because any even number would be off, and any odd number would be on. So you just keep adding them and adding them until you get like, all right, well now it says like 1, 1, 7, 3, 5. That means they're all on. So I can do it. I've added them all up and collectively ended up on odd numbers for everything.
Yeah, it is fun, right? Being so able to method
your way
through these.
Doing them very numerically is often the best way to do it.
They can be really hard.
Oh.
Those Nancy Drew ones, they did not coddle children.
I mean, we played on the harder difficulty, which I think they design it easy and then make the harder one hard, which is always leads
sometimes
to some very tough puzzles. And so, yes, yeah, so, some of them, like, we would be playing for ages and clicking through and attempting to be like, pull this, pull that, and trying to go by feel, and it never worked. And after, like, 20 minutes of that, we'd go, you know what, write it down, put numerical values to all of it, do a sum where they all add up to what you expect them to add up to, great. And then we'd do it in 10 minutes, 5 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, and but we have to do it to solve them. But that's like a good, for anyone who's at home and loves doing these types of puzzles but doesn't do well, it's a good trick. Just try and do it mathematically.
So, Marcus, has anything changed between you writing it, playtesting it, and everything from like playtests to our playing of it? How did things go differently?
You mean how between the playtest and how you guys experienced this?
Yeah, sure.
This?
And did anything, like, did the players do anything wildly different and or did puzzles have to change massively between them?
I don't think any puzzles massively changed. There were some big changes early on when I was figuring out this room. But I ended up having kind of the three-tiered structure of the isolation booth, then the live room, then the control room. And I kind of like that because then it's, you know, when you were in the booth, there were only so many things you could interact with, which meant that you would stumble on the things that you needed to interact with. But yeah, as far as changes, like big changes, I think the last person I playtested with, they actually couldn't figure out the bottom of the five things, for the lines, like the, I push people into lockers that just could not click for them. So there was kind of a story beat there of like RJ, like walks into the room and, like,
nice.
Is like, anyway, so like I guess there were small improv moment differences, but in general the puzzles stayed the same since the last playtest or so.
Oh, that's cool.
Nice. And anything major, like when you first wrote it, before you playtested it, was there anything that you had to throw out where you're just like, oh no?
Besides making the on air fewer switches.
Yeah, other than that one. Yeah.
Right. I can't remember. I don't know.
Like, conversely, were there any puzzles that you made that just slotted right into place, everything was perfect, and you were just happy immediately?
Yeah, straight away. The bop it. You're like, that's it. I've bopped it.
I mean, once I figured out that I wanted to do a bop it for the mic, that I think actually Nathan might have helped me come up with that idea. That was pretty easy to put together. And once I had the idea of having the numbers be on the panels, it wasn't too difficult to come up with a sentence that had all of them. Mm-hmm. Like, I kind of enjoy that sort of, like, dual-purpose writing. So, I don't know. It was all very fun to design. And it was also fun that I basically was imagining the studio that I work at for the locations. Like, it's not really that fictional. It was, in my head, at least, exactly the voice studio that I've worked at.
Yeah, and you know, like I've never really worked in a voice studio like that, but it's nice that you see it in movies and and documentaries and things like that enough to be like, I know what this looks like. And then when you say, it's got this control boot down here, and it's like, great. Yep,
we can
that fits.
Fill that into our like, heads that, pretty
that
reasonably.
That matches my mental picture.
That's true.
So it worked out. It worked out very well. On the note of that sentence, great job. Now you just need to enter the control room and yell for help. Is there anything written for entering the control room and yelling for help? Or is it just like nothing happens, you dummy?
I don't have anything written, so it was going to be some variation of that. But no one came, you know.
Fair
something
enough.
Like that.
Wonderful. Look, it was a very fun room. I really enjoyed playing through it.
Yeah, had a lovely time. I wish I'd been smarter through it, but
you know,
sometimes you're out of practice.
Couldn't keep up with my great puzzle solving.
One last question. How does it compare to other guest rooms you've done? Was it longer or shorter or easier?
I think the pacing was really nice, right? I'm not going to necessarily like compare it to other people's because lots of people get very good pacing. And
sure.
But I think it was a good understanding of, I think sometimes when people write one room, they try and go like, I've got to put everything in. I want to put so much in because I've got these ideas and these
I
ideas.
I might
and
never
these
do this again, therefore.
Right.
And I think probably just because you have your own other outlets for, you can put stuff into Rise of the Golden Idol. You can put stuff into Aurelius Whitlock. You didn't have, it didn't feel like you had that drive to be like, this one escape room has to represent all the things that I want to do in this type of medium. So I've got to try. And instead, which made it feel quite, I would say, compared to a lot of guest Game Master rooms, more reserved, more like, I know what should be here. I've put the things in here that would make sense. And here it is, which was quite nice, which made it feel more like, I think, playing one of your rooms, Danny, because you have that same thing. Like, you know you're going to write another one for the next episode and the next episode and the next episode, so you don't feel the need to put too many things in.
Yeah.
And I think that it was a similar feeling of restraint.
Yeah, that is cool. Good. At no point in this one did I feel overwhelmed.
Yes, yeah.
Which is nice.
Which is not saying that we do for all of the guest rooms or many of them, but there's a slight difference in flavor of how things are organized and what they're
like.
What's
some of the most amazing ones we've done, I have absolutely felt overwhelmed, but they're just slotted together in ways that were really impressive.
Thing. It's just,
just like an atmosphere.
It's a different feeling. Yeah. And I think this felt more like a Danny room in terms of.
Aww.
Yeah, I feel like. There's something nice about a room that goes smooth like butter, you know, like everything is like, oh, and good pace.
Yeah.
But it's also really satisfying when you have an experience when you're hard stuck, but then you get your way out of it. So
for sure. And yeah, in terms of difficulty, I felt like I was having a stupid day. So everything was slightly more difficult to me than it felt it should have been. Everything made sense and felt smooth enough in a way that it feels like, no, this shouldn't have been a particularly hard room. But again, we were just talking to someone about this yesterday, talking about the top escape rooms in the world. And they suggested, oh, so that means they're really hard. I just went, oh no, absolutely not. Often the exact opposite.
Yeah, the reason people like them so much is that they're easy enough that everyone was doing them and getting out.
Right.
Because it is good to feel challenged and accomplished, but you don't want things to grind to a halt ever.
I am a proponent of easier puzzles because the point, I think, of most escape rooms is just for people to feel clever. And I feel like, you know, the minority of people who are like score chasers and want to be like challenged. Mm. Kind of effects for the other people who just want to be clever. I don't know. I once did this, you know, difficulty high rated room, but I found that I kept on tripping myself up because I was giving them like the benefit of the doubt of like, oh, this orange is a very, very slightly different color than this red ish, you know, splotch on the wall. I'm sure that this is an old room and it's just slightly faded over time. Ah. And they were like, no, that's part of the difficulty. Very slight changes in color.
And see that, and that's the thing. Difficulty in puzzles is always interesting because sometimes difficulty can be from a puzzle that is satisfyingly complex and requires an understanding. You know, there's some difficulty in puzzles where you think, ah, of course, it must be like this, it must be like that, that is really, really interesting and rewarding and great. And I don't think difficult puzzles are ever fundamentally bad. But I do think that sometimes when people go, oh, I want to make this difficult, the easiest way to do that is to make it worse.
Is make it bad.
Yeah, exactly, right? A bad puzzle is always more difficult than a good puzzle. And so they're just like, well, why didn't you think about doing this? Or like, why didn't you notice a subtle difference in shade or of these two colors? Or why didn't you think to like see which of these eight things twists open when seven of them don't and there's no indicator that they would? And you're like, mm-hmm. well, because that would be silly to do that. That's why yeah. I didn't do it. And like, that's why it's hard. Because you wouldn't have thought to do it. And you're like, it's easy to make a puzzle. It's my classic example is always, how does Bilbo win his riddles in the dark?
yeah.
He just gives a bad riddle. What's in my pocket?
Yep.
You know? That's a bad riddle. Of course it's hard. Because there's no way of knowing. You can't work that out.
I really dislike arbitrary puzzles. I once was in a room where we were stuck because we needed like a digit code. And if we punched in the wrong code, it would make us wait minutes before we punch in another. But the thing is, you can't see a number and know for sure that that's the correct answer. So they were like, oh, no, you needed to order these royal families based on their location and then have read that detail rather than alphabetically or the order of the number of things on their house crest or whatever.
Yeah, it's like, why pick that over this?
Yeah, I'm a really big fan of puzzles that when you solve it or when you're close to solving it, it clicks, and that feeling of, it's like good enough. For example, Bill, you finding Orion.
Yes.
There was no doubt that that was an accident. You were like, I recognize that word. I know that that is a solution somewhere.
Exactly, right? It's that click. It's like when you do, so we occasionally also will stream or make video episodes doing like cryptic crosswords. And cryptic crosswords can be really tough and really wild, and we're not brilliant at them. But the benefit that they have, the thing that's really nice about a cryptic crossword, is you are always sure of your answer pretty much. Very, very rarely could you ever be confused, because even if you don't know it, if you guess something, you can always go, wait, is it testament? Looking back, it can't be anything other than that, because when it said exam, that meant test. And when it said, you know, a mint, that sounds like a mint. Okay, I get it. It all fits together. And like, they prove themselves. Even if you have to guess the answer, you can always check it and be like, now it all locks into place. Exactly.
Right.
And so you always know.
I mean, and occasionally there'll be fake light bulbs, but for the most part.
But again, like sometimes you have it, whenever you have that fake light bulb.
That's much easier in a regular crossword than a cryptic crossword.
Yeah, because regular crosswords aren't built like that. They're just like, did you put the word or not? And you might have the wrong word, even though it fit in. You'd be like, sorry, too bad.
Yeah.
Whereas cryptic crosswords, like in case you're saying, right, you might have a false light bulb, but you can always check it and be like, wait a minute, that doesn't actually make any sense. Mm-hmm. I'll move on now.
There was a puzzle hunt. I assume it was a Sydney Uni one, a sums puzzle hunt, but can't quite remember, a while ago, where regular crosswords with that problem was the entire concept of it. So it was just a crossword grid. This is where it started. And all of the clues had two possible answers that both would fit. The example they gave was Superman's girlfriend.
Lois Lane.
Or Lane.
No, it was Lana Lang.
Lana Lang, a different Superman girlfriend. Yeah.
And every single one of them, the entire puzzle was built around that idea.
Two things that could fit in that space that are both correct answers. Yeah.
I like it better when the incorrect answer, if you think about it, is incorrect. Like in The Golden Idol, we're okay with having puzzles that there's like a false answer that you can put in when you're describing things, but it needs to be like for sure incorrect. And if they really looked at it, you can see that it's incorrect.
Mm. Yes.
Not something that is like arbitrarily, it was one of these two things. We chose the other thing, so you're wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. There always has to be some thing that you can point to and be like, but because of this, that isn't true.
That cannot be true.
It's a good thing to have pretty much for all puzzles. Arbitrariness at any point is not even like a subjective, not my cup of tea. I think if there's ever an arbitrary point, it's like that's puzzles broken. Sorry. Or a deliberate joke about how to make puzzles wrong and then to use it.
Marcus, where do you think this fits in terms of murder mysteries? Because typically in a lot of murder mysteries that you read, it can still feel a bit arbitrary until the very last minute from the reader's perspective. And I love it when it's not, and you can actually like rule things out and stuff like that. But obviously, they often deliberately leave little blank spots that only the detective could possibly know. And then sometimes not even that. Sometimes it still ends up feeling arbitrary if it's not the best one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I think that some people who like murder mysteries dislike puzzles and vice versa. Like some people who like puzzles dislike murder mysteries because they're like, oh, they don't play fair. You know, I'm reading it to solve it and I'm not able to solve it. So there's definitely like some crossover between the two, but also like novels especially, I don't think play fair most of the time.
No.
I was only just recently listening to your bonus episode of talking about your favorite murder mysteries in media. And I can't remember, was it you or Nathan? One of you said, like, you just read a murder mystery without trying to solve it. You just read
That's
it.
That's me.
Yep. That was, we've had that discussion before. That's what Billy does. That's nonsense to me.
Yeah. Like, if I'm watching a murder mystery movie, it actually is really frustrating. I did try one time, oh, I'm going to try to solve it when I watch. And it made for a worse watching experience. I had a lot more fun when I was just like, I'm going to trust the movie is taking me a place it wants to take me.
But trust, I think, is also a big part of that, right?
Like, oh, right. True.
You have to know that the author is going to make it acceptable. Like, I think the key thing in my head that defines something being a whodunit rather than just a thriller or a murder
procedural
story is that it has to be solvable. I think a whodunit needs to give you all the information somewhere, heavily obfuscated, but they need to give you all the tools that you need so that you can reach the conclusion generally around like a page before the detective.
Yeah, it can be, right? It can take that long to get there.
And if it doesn't do that, Myers, like, this is a book about a detective.
Yeah.
But it's not a whodunit, because it's not really a murder mystery, because you could never.
You don't have all
you
the
could
information.
Never do. Like, who done it is a question that you could not answer. So why would it be asked to you, right? Also, it's not a real question. Who done it isn't good grammar. Who has done this?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, to me, that's so. I think if you trust them, or if you go with a feeling of trust, it can be quite fun to do. Like, we did that recently, watching through
Death and Other Details,
which has just finished its first season in. I think it's a Hulu show, maybe. We got on Disney Plus because it's Australia and it's all about whatever distribution. But really fun. Mandy Patinkin as a detective, and a really lovely cast and it from the beginning, it gave the impression of, don't worry, you'll be able
you're
to
in good hands.
Like,
these people
the
know
clues.
What they're doing, and you can see things happening.
And really in the script sort of encouraged obliquely to the audience, being like, hey audience, you could probably solve this, you should think
play.
About it. Like, play in the space, audience. And we trusted them and we went through the whole thing. And I think it pays off. I think it is true. They give you enough thing. If you actually engage with the show on what it presents.
We have to go back to episode one to make sure, don't
true.
We?
But I think you can. And so it was really quite fun together to sit and do that and talk it through. But with a book, I find it more difficult because I'm by myself. I don't have someone to like bounce ideas off and talk to.
I bounce off you when I'm reading them, even though you have no idea what I'm talking about when I'm reading the books.
It's quite difficult. So I think when I read, I'm usually easier of just being like, I'll just keep going with it. I'm not going to stop and try and figure it out.
We've proselyted this book on our own podcast, but have you read 7.5 Deaths?
Oh, yes.
Actually, I think we've read 7 Deaths.
No, we might have gotten 7.5 Deaths.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
The different names, different places.
Different names, different places. Yeah.
Same book.
I loved it.
It's a fantastic.
Absolutely.
I mean, you've sort of done your own version of that idea in one of your Aurelius Whitlocks, right? Of like a time loop murder mystery.
Yes. Yes.
Where is it? I want to read it again, but I can't see
can't
it on the shelf.
It's gone. I sold it.
I just love, I think this won't be a surprise, but I'm a fan of like a central like gimmick or conceit within a mystery. Mm-hmm. Other people like mysteries where you know the rules they're going to play by. I like mysteries where you have to learn the rules.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, that's fair.
I think that's really fun. So it's fun when it sounds like his next book is going to be like, everyone has their memories erased, so no one knows who the murderer is. And I'm like, you know, that sounds like it'll be a good time.
Good fun.
That's fun.
I think that is one of those things that I think when people are talking about, or if people are listening to Solve This Murder or listening to Aurelius Whitlock, I think that's probably is one of the defining differences between our shows, right? Is Aurelius Whitlock, you guys really like to sort of play with, like, what's the shtick of this new one, right? This is a time loop one. This one is but it has
supernatural creatures supernatural exist in this one.
This one has,
yeah,
right.
That turns out to be more a feature of regularity, I have come to realize.
And then, yeah, and ours is a bit more, or not, is much more like trying to emulate kind of specifically that Poirot-y Agatha Christie feel of like,
right, which I love, which is a lot of fun.
It's a bunch of people, it's in a room, figure out about the people, figure out then about some, and then solve like a classic
murder mystery
style.
You're right, that probably is the biggest difference in how our shows feel.
In the two shows, which is nice because they each like sort of, they carve out a unique space in otherwise a fairly similar structure, which works really
well. Well, it gives people a reason to listen to both.
Exactly.
You know? You don't need to pick a favorite.
No, that's really cool. And yeah, it's interesting in that way. Would you say that Death and Other Details did that in the tiniest possible way?
It did it in the tiniest possible way. I don't want to spoil anything about the show, but I will say that that there is a theme throughout which is about memory and about details in memory. So and whether or not they're fundamentally
trustworthy. It gives you something
that's
not a gimmick exactly, but it is a focus. It is telling you sort of the biggest element you should be paying attention to.
And I do like that because as someone, like, this is one of my things that you learn whenever you do anything about like forensics and evidence and stuff is if a person says, here's what I remember, and then tells you a bunch of stuff, don't listen to them. They're probably wrong. Like, you know, and so when I watch shows, or read like murder mystery stuff where it's just like, let me tell you what I remember on that night 13 years ago. My actual like forensics brain goes, no, I don't care. I don't care
That's
what you remember
garbage.
13 years ago. Literally, you've made it up. You don't know you've made it up, but you've made all of this up.
Way back in the day, the Agatha Christie book, Elephants Can Remember, I stopped reading that one a couple of chapters in because it was a long cold case.
Yeah.
And I went, I'm not interested in what people are trying to remember from that long ago.
I don't trust them.
Yeah.
Interesting.
But yeah, it's a very interesting, and I remember the same thing because I have a forensics degree, and I remember being told that when someone said, like, when you do an investigation and you write up your notes and your case notes, you write them all up, you write exactly what you were thinking, try and put as much information as you can, and you're going to get called onto a stand 10 years down the road when something happens with this case. And when they do that, your job is to say, what did I write in my notes? And they say, you this. And go, great, that's what I think. Well, what do you think now? Doesn't matter. What did I write in my notes? That's what I think. I'm not going to add any information. I'm not going to extrapolate. I'm not going to remember any new details because you cannot rely on any details that I remember now, only what I wrote then. That was written at the time. Anything I remember now is irrelevant. I'm not adding anything to my testimony. I'm not adding anything to my notes. I'm not going to be like, oh, maybe there was a smell of no.
Oh, now that you mention it.
Yeah, now that you mention it. None of that. If it's not in the notes, I don't care. That's what I think.
Oh, Death and Other Details did that written down. So well. Really enjoyable.
And it's just a really interesting sort of thing. So
I'll definitely look it up. I'm interested in the show.
It's a great, and you get to see Mandy Patinkin run around being Mandy Patinkin, which is always great because he's fantastic. all right. Well, I think that we could probably leave it there.
We could talk about murder mysteries for a long while.
We could.
But another day.
Well, yeah, so thank you so much again for coming on and,
running
that room. It was great fun. We really enjoyed it, and I think people really enjoy listening through to it. If you wanted to direct people to other stuff that you're doing, where can people find more Marcus?
The main thing I am doing is Aurelius Whitlock's Murder Museum, which maybe Bill and Danny will put a link in the description.
If we feel like
there'll be links
it.
Specifically to our recent guest appearances where we solved a murder that you wrote.
Yeah.
Solved it. Good.
Absolutely. Yeah, they did a great job. They dealt with the gimmicks and it was great fun. But yeah, I don't think I have a specific website or anything to plug. Just if you can spell it right, you can find me wherever you get your podcasts.
Lovely. And then look, the
as
other
a
thing,
compliment, you have a very spellable name.
Aurelius Whitlock is, or Marcus Richardson
Marcus
is.
Marcus Richardson is.
Yeah, Aurelius Whitlock's crazy. And then, of course, the other thing that we mentioned, we haven't talked about it much in detail, but that's because you'll all get to see it soon, is that we're all working on Rise of the Golden Idol, which is shaping up really nicely. It's all coming together. It's looking very good.
I'm very interested to see it as the one finished, coheeded product.
If you haven't played the original and you're listening to this, go and play Case of the Golden Idol, it's a fantastic puzzle game. There's a reason that we applied to work on the sequel, because we loved the original so much. It is by far the biggest source of my friend's jealousy at this point ever in my life, to be like, hey, I'm working on Rise of the Golden Idol. What? You idiot, how dare you? I want to be working on Rise of the Golden Idol. It's fantastic. And play the first one. And if you have played the first one, wishlist the second one on Steam. Go to Steam or wherever you want to buy it and hit it, add it to your wishlist. And then
one remembers when games come out.
You're not going to remember when it comes out. And this shows, and then it means that, like, when it comes out, you'll all buy it. And the publisher can look at all these wish lists and be like, ooh, it's getting big. So go and wishlist it if you're listening now.
And if Rise of the Golden Idol is successful, then I bet you could probably expect to see Bill and Danny's name on more really cool things in the future, you know?
Fall of the Golden Idol.
Other opportunities.
Wonderful. All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you so much, Marcus, for coming and running the room. And thank you, Danny, for playing it with me.
Yeah. Thank you for actually solving them.
I solved the things. Well, given that you actually wrote the mystery, you wrote the whole room.
It was charity. Really,
you were just letting him have a chance. That's right. It was a delight. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. And for everyone listening, thank you so much for listening and supporting the show. If you want to support the show, the easiest thing to do is to tell people about it. Jump online, post about it. Share things. If you're floating around the internet and someone mentions something that's vaguely related, be like, hey, check out Escape This Podcast. And you can also support us on Patreon. We don't have ads on the show. We make all of our income through Patreon, so that we can make a show that we feel super proud of, and not have to worry about all that sort of stuff. But if you want to help support the show, anyone who signs up at any level can be an NPC in one of Danny's rooms. So I don't think anyone would have magically appeared in this one, unless there's a Raspy Jim on the Discord, on the Patreon.
Thank you, RJ.
I'm going to change my name to Raspy Jim on the Discord now.
And then there's bonus audio. Every week there's a new episode for our $5 donors of some either behind the scenes footage of recordings of us doing playtests, or there's 2-minute mysteries, or there's a whole bunch of weird fun stuff. There's monthly vlogs for the $10 donors. Lately, we've been doing reactions to escape rooms in other media, which has been a lot of fun. There's trivia for $20 donors. It's a whole bunch of fun stuff. So it's a great way to support the show and to support the rest of the people who listen to the show, right? They can get it for free because people help support the arts and put money into the Patreon and you know, it's literally, you are literal patrons. You're like... You're like a classic old Italian family being like, Da Vinci, please, you can paint. Here is 200 million lira. Is this what we use? Who knows? Go, Da Vinci, paint.
Just take this gold bullion.
Take this bullion and paint, Da Vinci, but not with the bullion. You're like that. That's you. Thank you, everybody, for supporting the show. All right. Bye, everybody.